I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. Our guest this hour, Jeremy Suri, is a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's written a very interesting piece that caught our attention that looks at the passivity of young citizens, particularly those in Europe and in the United States, which he says has become a common topic of conversation. Why aren't Europe's young people rioting anymore? Why is it that the young are not only passive, they are resigned to low expectation? They have low voting rates, low employment rates, stagnant education rates. They are ever more focused on the internet and social media communications rather than face-to-face interactions. They're fragmented, uncertain, and anxious about their futures. Jeremy writes about this in a recent piece. He holds the Mac Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs, author of many books on history, politics, and foreign policy, including Power and Protest, Global Revolution, and the Rise of Détente. And we found a piece that he wrote on May 13th, very interesting, A Generation in Need of Hope. Jeremy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
So they're passive, resigned to low expectations. In Europe, why do you center on Europe and in America? Are things different in other countries?
Well, I think we are seeing a lot more youth activism in the Arab world and in a number of countries, and including in Ukraine. So we should be careful not to use Europe as a blanket statement. I'm referring more to Western Europe. But I think what we're seeing is that in Western Europe and in the United States in particular, in these areas, young people are dissatisfied, but they think they're living better than many counterparts elsewhere, and they're afraid to rock the boat. So they have more to lose, which is, I think, why they're also more passive.
Mm-hmm. You say they're nervous about the future, and so it drives a combination of live-for-the-moment materialism and concern about grades and credentials. What are they worried about? They won't find a job?
I think they're worried they won't find a job. They're worried they'll do something today that will be held against them down the line. Part of it is because what they do is recorded so much more heavily now in pictures and images and sound and all sorts of other ways, but also because they think it's going to be more competitive, and anything that can be held against you might be held against you. So for that reason, Kathleen, they're more risk-averse.
Really? But they put all kinds of things about themselves up on Facebook.
Well, that's just it. They put things up on Facebook about their social activities, and they get themselves into a lot of trouble about that. But they don't want to be labeled as being politically extreme in one form or another, because they're afraid they'll apply for a job from someone who has a different set of politics. And in our partisan world, partisanship seeps into their thinking just as it does into the thinking of older citizens.
Right. And is there some validity to that? It used to be that people would say, oh, that was in your youth, you're a changed person, now you're more mature. Do things stay with people forever now?
I don't think they do, but I do think that people form networks early on, and these networks are more and more important in getting people into the positions they want to get into. And if they're forming networks and they're seen as being someone who shouldn't belong to a certain network because of their beliefs, then that's a whole group of contacts they're closed off to, and that makes it harder for them to get the jobs that those contacts would open up for them.
Hmm. So there is this is way outside my my realm here, because I got Midwestern sensibilities here. So fill me in. But you say that there are lots and lots of students from around the world who want to enroll in the best American and European universities, even though these babies are like $50,000-$60,000 a year. They want the elite status that comes from Harvard, Oxford, Stanford. Why?
Well, they want it because it opens a network to them, as we were just talking about. But also, it identifies them, it sorts them, and identifies them as people who are employable in certain kinds of jobs. Ben Wadowski is someone who's written about this, and he calls it the great brain race. And people want to identify themselves as being the people with the right brains. And so they're very focused on this, not so much what they're going to learn when they're in these universities, but getting that credential.
Mm. And I would think that it kind of narrows the population. There was a piece in the New York Times, we're going to do a show on it down the road here, about how colleges have, particularly those elite institutions, if you're somebody who's been scrambling to get by, your family has, you have almost no chance at all of getting into one of these places. So you're taking the elite, who are children of the elite, who are going to these elite schools, and then everybody, they perpetuate being elite, but nobody else can get there.
Well, there is a lot of that that's happening. There's a number of people who have written about this. Suzanne Mettler is a sociologist at Cornell who's written about it. It's not that you don't have any chance, but it's that the chances are less than we think they are. The vast majority of students in elite universities have had either parents with a similar background or have had access to elite preparation. Now, it could be elite preparation even in a poor environment. But what you don't have are people who are coming out of poor neighborhoods with poor schools getting into these schools in any large numbers.
Right, yeah. The political disengagement of the young is the difference, the biggest difference, you write, between our time and prior eras. How could that be? We just went through this election where young people turned out, it was a few years ago now, but hope and change were the themes of the Obama campaign. People rallied for him on college campuses. It was a really big deal. Is it over?
I don't think it's over, but we're certainly in a pause moment. I remember 2008 very, very vividly. I was in Madison at the time.
Oh, yeah?
And it was an extraordinary moment. People were engaged. There was a sense of change. Young people felt that they were part of politics as they hadn't been before, and then that dissipated, and it certainly didn't come back with the 2012 election. It was a poor imitation of that in many ways.
Right.
And I think there are many things we could talk about with this, but one of the biggest is the absence of imagination. Young people are not encouraged to think about a better world. They're encouraged to think about just getting ahead in this world. And if you're not thinking about alternatives, there's no reason to go out and be active for anything.
Do you need somebody to help you get inspired? Can you fault Obama for not living up to hope and change?
Yes, I think one can. Now, I think we should recognize it's very hard, and he's had many, many obstacles. So, you know, the real question is, how do we apportion the blame? He's one of many people to be blamed for this. But I think, yes, I think the message people get is a message of low expectations, that our society has difficulties, and we need to accept a lot of things that we don't think we should accept, rather than thinking through how we can make it better. And young people need individuals to inspire them and to offer them pathways that they can then take and redefine for themselves.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of partying going on?
Yes. So there's a study I cite on this, which is you're basically paying to party. And I don't think there's more partying on college campuses than there was before. There's probably actually less drug use in some ways. But I think what the point that this study offers is that, and this is based on two scholars who actually spend upwards of a year with students at a particular university, is that the partying is part of the social networking, and you're paying to be a part of that networking, and that's why you're in school as much as anything else, and there's less learning going on than there could be, and that the partying is actually stratifying class differences, because you have to be of a certain economic background to afford to be part of these particular parties.
Mm-hmm. You also write about, and I'm wondering if there are lots of similarities between young people partying hard in the Cold War and probably not having a whole lot of hope and people now. Is there a similarity?
Well, yes, again, I think, and we know this, you know, even pre-World War II, I mean, university life, college life has always involved, you know, young people doing all these kinds of experimentation and fun-loving activities that is, quite frankly, they should do. I wish I could do more of it now. You know, I think that's fine. That's not new. I don't even think there's more of that. But the question is, what are the stakes and what else is associated with that? I think in the first half of the 20th century, it was often associated with showing that you were from the right breed of people. That's why we have clubs and all sorts of things. In the mid-Cold War, it was about sort of letting off steam before you go out into the big world. But now I do think it's actually professional in a sense. That's the point they make in this study, that people are partying with people who they think they're going to be associating with the rest of their lives. And this is part of the formation of networks. Some people are included, some people aren't included.
Hmm. Boy, I think I haven't had much of a life of partying. When we say partying, I don't remember partying much at all. I feel really deprived, and I'm old now. I better get
Not
to
at all.
It.
There's always time to party.
I guess there's always time to party. All right, contrast this with the public protests behind the Arab Spring, the popular revolt in the Western Ukraine, even the Occupy movement, which seems to have lost some steam, but it was present for a while.
Right. Well, so the Arab Spring and the movements in Ukraine are fascinating, because they involve a broad coalition of people in both of these societies, or both of these sets of societies, who were not only fed up with what they had now, but really thought they could change things. And whether they did or didn't is a debatable proposition, and only history will tell. But these involved people going into the streets, changing their governments, because they believed that they could bring better governments into power, and believed that the old governments were not just corrupt, but that they could do better than those governments. And I think a lot of young people in Western Europe and the United States today, they don't have quite the same degree of criticism of their government, but they share a lot of the dissatisfaction with their society that their colleagues in other parts of the world did. But they don't think they could do any better. So there's no reason to protest. There's no reason to demand change if you don't think the change is going to be any different from what we have now. And that's, I think, the big difference. We have less hope than young people did in Tahrir Square a few years ago. And it's not that students are depressed either. It's that they just think this is the world the way it is. We should just succeed in it as it is rather than trying to change it. And you seem naive if you think you can change the world in their eyes.
All right, let's get the audience involved. Facebook message from John. We are at the end of an era with the unsustainability of our economic system becoming more obvious every day. Compounding this reality is global climate change. Older generations, however one defines them, are doing little to deal with these realities. So the idea that some new arbitrary generation like the millennials should be doing all the dirty work is arrogant. Doubly arrogant.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to that. I don't disagree with John's point, which is, just to restate, I think is a good point. It's that, why blame the young people when they haven't made the mess, and why expect them to solve other people's messes? And I sort of agree with a lot of that. But I think part of my point is that older people, those who have lived longer, need to do more to encourage young people to be idealistic again rather than the opposite. And what I experience, as well as what I read about and study, is more and more parents and grandparents encouraging their students, to be pre-professional rather than interested in changing the world. Go to college and get a job, rather than go to college and learn how to make the world a better place. And that they need to change that. So I'm in agreement with John on this. Even if people have made mistakes, it's time in their lives to encourage young people to see through their mistakes.
Can you point to a generation, to a decade, to an era of lots of idealism?
Yeah, the 1960s was. I mean, and many people, many of your listeners have lived through this. I've written about it. It's a decade that was filled with lots of good and bad. This is not to say, you know, it was necessarily a better world. But young people in the 1960s, when they went to college, they really thought they were going to change the world. Large numbers of them. They didn't all agree, by the way. There were people on the left and the right, and all places in between. But the sense was that the world was going to change, and that maybe you'd ride a bus in the South, or maybe you'd protest against the Vietnam War, or maybe you'd go into the Army voluntarily before you were drafted. That maybe you'd go and argue for women's rights. You would be involved. You would be engaged. Part of being a young person was being part of these movements, even if you weren't always on one side or the other. And that was part of the experience. That's not the experience young people have today.
And what happened to those people who were part of those experiences in the 60s? Are they still?
Well, I think, I mean, they've gone in many different directions, right? We have a lot of good studies of this. Many of them do become important political and social and community actors and make a huge difference. And our society is better for that. We're more, we have major problems, but we are more enlightened on certain issues than we were before. That's one element of it. Many become frustrated and just turn inward and return to being professionals. And many people forget, you know, they do that and move on to different things, which is totally natural, and forget. And so you have a lot of children or grandchildren of 60s activists who are now being told to be pre-professional rather than to be activists as their parents or grandparents were. And that's an interesting dynamic in human memory.
Right. Jeremy Seery is our guest. We're talking about a generation in need of hope. He's a professor of history and public affairs years at University of Texas at Austin and author of many books, including Power and Protest, Global Revolution and the Rise of Détente. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I anticipate we'll have a lot of calls on this, so get your calls in early. You can also send us a message on email, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for the hour. Not more in the course of everything, but the first for this hour, Dave in Appleton. Hi, Dave.
Hello there. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
My question or comment, looking for a reaction, is that I struggle with what kind of a role I can play. And given the fact that we've had the rise of corporations and their influence on our political system, it seems as though we no longer have a representative form of government, and that the politicians we have are bought and paid for. So it becomes very difficult for an individual to see as though they have any form of influence. And I'm wondering how the guest would respond to that.
All right, Jeremy.
Well, I think Dave has a point. Well, two points really. One being, of course, that there's a lot more money in politics, and that means that those of us who don't have a lot of money to throw around, it's harder to have influence. And second, the world is more complex. Institutions are more complex. Issues are more complex. So it's hard to also see the direct effects of what we do. But I think the place to really start is to start with encouraging and modeling for young people that there is value in getting involved. Too often, young people think that getting involved in something they're doing to build their resume, and it's talked of that way. And that leads them to choose things that are worthwhile doing, but that really are resume builders. I think modeling for young people, encouraging young people, helping them get involved in things because it's the right thing to do, because they believe in it, and making it clear that they can believe in different things and still find different avenues of political involvement. I think that's really important. And quite frankly, if everyone like Dave found two or three young people they knew and encouraged them to do this and got them to do it, that would change our politics more than throwing a lot of money at the system. Mm-hmm. But not enough people like Dave are asking that question.
And could those young people make a living doing those things?
Well, I don't know if they could or not, but what I tell my students is, you're 21. This is the time to take risks. Mm-hmm. You're not going to do it when you're 35 and you have a mortgage and children. Do it now, and even if you have debt, which I wish you wouldn't have, and that's a problem.
Right.
And that's also slowing people down or keeping them away from becoming politically active. But nonetheless, take risks early. Get involved early. You don't have to sacrifice an income, but, yeah, you might make less now. But this is the time to take risks.
Thank you so much, Dave, for your call. Ruth in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to say that, you know, in terms of generational activity, the people being involved, I think there's a lot of roles of people of all ages doing this work in community and doing a stellar job of it, but it doesn't get covered by the local media. I just came from an event locally in Eau Claire, and our local leader, Telegram, wouldn't even advertise the event in the community for a speaker who was talking about, you know, how to challenge corporate rule. And there was a good number of people who came, but again, the leader, Telegram, wasn't there to cover it. It won't be in our local paper. They would not advertise it. And I've seen that happen time and time again. There are things that older generations and younger generations are doing together, but it doesn't get any coverage. So it appears as though it's not there when it is very much there. And one of the points that was being made at this meeting I was at, or this presentation, is that, you know, we really have to look at local control, more local control, and really challenging, you know, state regulations that preempt local control.
Thank you, Ruth, for your call.
I agree 100%. I agree 100% with Ruth, and it shouldn't sound like we're in any way diminishing the very good work that a lot of people do across all age groups and backgrounds and everything. And it's definitely true; it doesn't get as much media coverage in many cases. Sometimes it's also that groups that are doing good work aren't able to put the resources into procuring the media coverage that they should be getting. There are a lot of media outlets today, and that's an area where people could all learn to do a better job, though the mainstream media should also pay more attention to this. My point, though, is focused really on people on college campuses, and what my piece does is try to look historically at the differences, and at least among college students, there's a lot less activism today. That doesn't mean there isn't any. There still is some. There still is some major activism, but there's a lot less of it, and particularly a lot less of it around political and economic issues. And that's the difference that I see, and that's, I think, a huge part that's missing from our dialogue. Mm-hmm. Young people should be part of our discussion about inequality and mm-hmm. political representation, and they're not right now.
You know, and that's very interesting in another sense, because they're living through a time of perhaps the greatest economic inequality in history.
That's right. That's right. That was one of my motivations in writing this. They're living through it, and they are going to have to pay the price on it. They're going to live with the consequences of it. And they're not a voice in that discussion, and they should be. And college campuses provide them an opportunity, because they do get media coverage on college campuses when there are major activities on college campuses.
Mm-hmm. And yet it's also one of those issues somebody talked about earlier. How do you take on the issue of income inequality? I mean, it's huge. It defines our societies in so many ways, and who has access and who doesn't, and who's got all the money and who doesn't, and how that affects those who have the money, how it affects those who don't have the money. But how the heck do you take that on as an issue, Jeremy? What do you do about it?
Well, I think you're right. It's a huge issue, and it's hard to know where to dig in, and there are no easy answers. But I do think there are a couple of things that college students could focus on. First of all, there is the issue of debt, how debt is handled, right? And many of them have college debt, and the laws are written in a way in which even if you go bankrupt, your college debt stays with you. We've done this strange mm-hmm. thing, which is make college debt the hardest thing for young people to shed and the hardest thing for them to deal with. There could be more activism around that, and they could raise a lot of attention on that issue that they all feel and in some ways all have expertise in because they're dealing with it.
Right.
Second, elections. Young people, even though some people are trying to stop them from voting, they have enormous voting power.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that happened in the 1960s is young people, particularly in places like Madison, Wisconsin, and Austin, Texas, and Ann Arbor, Michigan, they became important voting blocks, too.
Mm-hmm.
And around elections, and I don't just mean national elections, I mean state elections, I mean local elections, they can do much, much more. On these issues. And then the third issue I would point to would be the issue of immigration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think this is a place, campuses are filled, thankfully, with people from various parts of the world. And this is a model in many ways of the people we're trying to keep in our society as high-skilled performers. They could raise awareness of these issues a lot more than they do.
We welcome your phone calls, too. What do you think about this issue? Do we have a young generation that's in need of hope? Were you a member of a generation that was active in some way? And if so, what did you do? Did you feel like when you were young, you should go out and change the world? And did it govern your life in some way? If you're a young person now, do you feel a lack of hope? Do you think that things are so uncertain that you have to make sure that you have a good job, you go to a good school? Or are there issues that you are actively working on? Or is everybody just real passive about everything? We welcome your phone calls. Our lines are open for you right now, you passive people. You, sorry, I didn't mean to say that, but you know, you could inform us, particularly young people. What do you think about this? You're getting a bad rap. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter. You can use that as a form of communication. So many ways to get a hold of us. And that's @KDunnShow. Are there studies, you mentioned that people are more likely to become bankers than they are to become mayors. Are there studies of what professions young people are going into, and is it a radically different thing? Are they going into banking professions and money-making more so than they used to?
Well, I'm sure there are studies. I don't know those studies very well, so I can't answer that, but I can say fewer of them are going or running for political office or getting involved in politics than before. We do know that. We know that major universities like University of Texas and University of Wisconsin and others, traditionally people had gone through those universities and gotten involved in their state politics, mm-hmm. run for state representative, county commissioner, all these sorts of things, school board. I mean, there's a range of offices we're talking about here, and that's less likely today. In fact, you're probably less likely than ever before if graduating from Wisconsin or the University of Texas or Berkeley to go into any of those positions, in part because you're pressured and you have a financial need to make money to pay off your debt, but in part because those don't seem like the appropriate pathways. I ask my students this all the time. Why don't you run for office? They say they don't know how to raise enough money.
Right, right, yeah.
But second, they say they don't want their names slung through the mud.
Right.
And that's what I see as an absence of hope. What they don't say also, or what I would like them to say is, well, you know, there's something I really believe in, and I wish I could find a way to run for that. But they don't have that thing to believe in. And that's what's lacking. People will take on these difficulties if they believe there's something to aspire to. And we need to figure out how to propose alternatives so people can get behind them.
Dina in Madison, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good. So I'm a young person. I am turning 27 tomorrow, and
Happy birthday.
I live in Detroit, Michigan. And I guess my question is how the guest would define hope. I look at a lot of my friends, and many of them are very active in their communities but don't vote and are very much disenchanted with the political system. However, they're very involved in alternative ways, whether it be new forms of business and small economic development, nonprofit organizations that are using creative models to get folks employed. So I guess I would define your sentence or finish your sentence by saying young people need hope or young people lack hope in our political system. However, I think there's a lot of different metrics and ways to define that, ways to measure how young folks are involved. So I guess I would just ask for sort of your definition or a response.
Yeah, no, this is a good point, Dana. And again, I think, I'm not saying young people are lazy, and I'm not saying they don't care. I think they're hardworking, harder working probably than they've been in prior generations, and I think they do care. I know they care, and I talk to them when those are my students and others. So they're involved in a lot of things, and they're creative in certain ways. But I see trouble understanding how people could have hope in our society if they have no hope in our politics. It doesn't mean they have to think politics is the only place to have hope. But so much of our society is dependent upon the ways in which money and institutions are organized, and politics have a crucial impact on money and institutions. So I am fine with people pursuing change in all kinds of ways, but if you're doing it without any connection to the politics, if you're doing it by pushing the politics away, I don't see how it's providing any large hope of any kind, and that's what worries me. So I don't think it should only be about politics, but I think there has to be a political element of it, and the political system has to be seen as an enabler or has to be made into an enabler rather than something to be avoided. Otherwise, we're not really producing hope.
Thank you so much, and happy birthday, Dana. Go get 'em. Dale in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Hi. Hey,
hi.
Just some perspective. I have three kids, one out of college about 5 years, one just graduating, and I have a daughter who's in college right now. And, you know, I do think there's, and I think you kind of touched on this, I mean, it's so expensive now, and they're, you know, they're concerned, and in our situation, all three of my kids, you know, while we helped them as much as we could, they, you know, they worked, so they're working, they're going to school, and I'm not saying that didn't happen years ago, but I think if you went to school in the 70s, 80s, you could graduate, you know, what was it, $3,000, $4,000 a year. And now, if you can get out of college and you're not $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in debt, and I think kids are really, you know, I don't want to say having a tough time because both my two sons that graduated did okay with it. But, you know, they're very focused on classes and work and, you know, I think I'm very political and talk about politics a lot, follow politics. And my kids, you know, my one son's interested. The other ones just don't seem to be interested. It's like they just got other stuff to worry about. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, I don't know if that speaks to what you said, but if that's part of it. But just for what it's worth, I'll hang up and listen to your...
thank you. Thank you. And it's worth a lot. That issue of debt is a huge issue for this generation.
I think it is. I think Dale's comments struck home for me. I mean, I think what happens is the financial pressures create a financial priority for people.
Mm-hmm.
And if finances are your priority, it's hard to think about getting involved in any kind of political change, especially anything that might involve risk. Finances have to be a part of everyone's life. I'm not trying to live in, you know, a fairy tale land here, but I am thinking financial issues should not be a number one for people 19, 20, 21 if we want them to be creative
mm-hmm.
and to take risks. And what Dale is describing is exactly what's happened in our system.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call. And we go to, is it Dave? Another day. Oh, no, it's Matt. Matt in Madison. Hi.
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 Hi. My question for your guest is what he thinks about what technology is, like new technology, the role it's playing in this. Because what I see is kids walking down the street with headphones on, not really paying attention to what's going on around them. Kids playing video games, and they can't hear anything outside of that, even if their parents are talking about issues in the world today. You know, they're not going to hear it because they're so focused on the video games or their texting or,
mm-hmm.
you know, all these different things. I'm just wondering if he's seen that too.
Well, I mean, a lot of people have tried to study this. I don't know, Matt, if there are any, you know, really good detailed studies of this, but there's no doubt people are using more devices. We all are using more
right.
devices. And it does change the way we interact. We spend a lot more time looking at screens than we often do face-to-face. But on the one hand, these mechanisms do allow for an exchange of information, and they have, for instance, in the Arab Spring movements, been very effective at helping people to organize. So they have that positive effect, it seems. But on the other hand, they tend to create, and I think this is what I think we're seeing in the United States in particular, they tend to create like-minded talk groups where you find people just like yourself. And you're not actually exchanging information with people who are different from you. So they're people far away, but they share your same ideas. And that discourages activism because what happens is you end up complaining to one another and convincing one another there's nothing you can do about it rather than having a more broad-gauge discussion. Activism is fundamentally about people exchanging ideas and bringing together different points of view to try to pursue change.
Mm.
And I think what happens is we become fragmented by the world of internet chat rooms and social media.
Yeah, it is. It's a whole different world. But wasn't that true in the 60s, the generation you mentioned? Didn't people of like mind sort of hang out with people of like mind?
They did, but what was lovely about college campuses is they ran up against people with different views. And that's the part of the 60s that some people don't remember is that there were people with many different views, and there might have been a bias on one campus one way and another campus another way, but you had to confront the issue head on, and you were talking about the issue, and even if everyone in your group believed in it, you felt there were other people around you who thought differently, and there was an effort to engage them. Most of the 60s movements are not focused primarily at trying to act out. They're focused on trying to communicate, to change the way people view things. The civil rights movement is all keyed upon exposing the racism of our society and getting people to talk about it and want to change it. That involves a public discussion of people across backgrounds and points of view.
Yeah. Let's go to Pat in Milwaukee. Hey, Pat.
Hey, guys. I'm kind of you can disagree with the premise a little bit. I think you can separate activism from politics. And frankly, what I've seen, I'm a little older now, 35, but I graduated from UW-Madison. And, wasn't all that political at the time. And I vote and get involved a little bit. But frankly, what we've seen over the past, 10, 12, 15 years, nothing changes. It doesn't matter who's in power. Frankly, the system's so messed up. And, I think as an individual living in America, you look around and you realize things are actually pretty good here. And I think you're more concerned about good relationships with family and friends, putting enough money in your pocket to have a comfortable life, and doing what you can to help out. But the acrimony when you start talking about politics and
mm-hmm.
Facebook and this and that, it just causes more fights.
Mm-hmm.
It causes more more pain and more trouble than what it's worth to actually get anything accomplished. And what I've seen from a lot of my friends the last 5 or 6 years is just a lot less talking about it, you know. And, you know, I think in the long run, it's a little bit better to, you know, have a happy life and good relationships than try and prove somebody wrong over a political idea.
Interesting points, Jeremy.
Well, I think Pat has captured exactly how a lot of people think, and it's a very reasonable point of view. It's very rational. It's also exactly the problem. I'm not criticizing Pat in any way. But what he said leads one to think you can't change the political system, and you shouldn't change it, and that's what I mean by the absence of hope.
Mm-hmm.
Our society has improved when people have tried to change the political system. It has not improved in moments when people simply accept it as it is. And
mm-hmm.
that's my problem, is that we're accepting it as it is, just as Pat said, because we're not satisfied with it, but we, you know, we don't think we can do any better, and we'd rather just tend our own gardens.
Yeah.
And that's an enormous loss for us as a society.
Well, how do you foster hope? In several callers have been getting at this era of profound, profound partisanship. So you've got, we were talking about this yesterday, the Supreme Court and how for the first time in history they're political. You look at redistricting and how, and even to run for office, you have to make sure you live in a district if you're a Republican or a Democrat, because otherwise you have absolutely no chance of being elected to anything. If you watch a certain kind of media, then it reinforces your opinion. You don't have too many kind of down the middle of the road, let's engage in all points of view here. I mean, holy cow, of course people are having a hard time jumping in. Let's change everything, because things are so deeply, deeply entrenched.
I agree. I think that's an accurate assessment of where we are. It's not unique to this moment, but it's definitely true. But that's what I find so perplexing about young people, because they're not that way. They don't come to university that polarized. They really don't.
Mm-hmm.
They become polarized later in life, but they're not that polarized when they arrive at university. And so this should be a space where they should be at least trying to talk about these issues. And even if they believe they can't from campus change what's happening on the Supreme Court or in Congress or in the White House, they can at least be talking and getting active on campus about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not as polarized on campus. But yet, the problem is they're not doing that. They've internalized the partisanship of an elder generation that is not their own partisanship.
Hmm. Let's go to Dave in Milwaukee. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I guess I go back to when I volunteered my kids in school. Someone asked me, why do you volunteer in school? I said, well, if school's a part of me, I'll be a part of my kids. I'm involved in politics. My kids come to rallies. We go to rallies together. We talk about it all the time. And you know, I'm really concerned about this country now, because if things don't change soon, I kiddingly say occasionally that what we need to do is drag these fat cats out of their house, beat the crap out of them, and take their money and say, now you live. I don't want to see the revolution come again in this country, but if things don't change soon, if we don't do something about that, I think it's going to happen.
Jeremy.
Well, I don't know. It's very hard. The hardest thing for historians is to predict revolutions. I don't see that happening, but I see the argument for that. But what I do see happening is growing discontent and growing unrest of different kinds. And the distinction I would draw would be between political activism and violence out of disillusionment and things of that sort. And I'm concerned that we might go in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned that there are whole elements of our society that are being left behind.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what we're talking about here. But I don't think that's necessarily revolution, but I do think that's instability and unrest.
More phone calls momentarily. Please stay on the line, and we'll be with you momentarily. We're talking this hour with Jeremy Suri and looking at Generation in Need of Hope. He's a professor of history, public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, where he holds the Mac Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs. He's the author of many books, including Power and Protest, Global Revolution and the Rise of Détente. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. One line is open if you've been trying to get through. 800-486-8655, our number. Also on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter at K Dunn Show. Matt in Eau Claire, hi.
Yes, hi. I guess I have more of a comment or observation. I'm 29, and I care about a lot of things, but I think people are, I think young people more so than, but people in general, I think are just apathetic until, you know, there's a problem that confronts them. I mean, look at our federal government. We have $1 trillion or close to $1 trillion deficit right now. If they had to balance the budget by either raising taxes or cutting tons of programs, I mean, every politician would be voted out of office. So until the, you know, the debt comes due, I think most people are just, you know, happy as is.
Jeremy.
There's a point. Debt is at the root of this debt in terms of student debt, but also our society living with a lot of debt, a lot of obligations we're not paying back and not wanting to talk about where we have to cut back, how we might have to rethink how we operate. This would be true also in the area of environmental activities. And so in a certain way, we're going forward without wanting to confront the tough issues. This is what I would call the sometimes absent courage in our society. I, again, don't think that comes from young people because they recognize, as Matt does, these issues, and they actually want to solve them, but they just don't think it can happen. And they think too many other people in society don't want to actually deal with the real issues here. We spend a lot of money on entitlements for people who are not young people, and young people don't necessarily think that's the right allocation of resources, but they don't think there's an avenue to talk about that.
Thanks, Matt. William on Facebook, perhaps the youth see climate change as a huge issue no politician is doing anything about, which leads them to a fatalistic view of life.
I think that's accurate. I think young people overwhelmingly in the data I've seen believe climate change is a huge problem. Many of them rank it as a number one problem. But they see our politics deadlocked on this, and they're discouraged from getting involved with it, actively discouraged by people who have an economic interest in actively discouraging them, but also actively discouraged by people who just don't think change is going to happen. And we need to come up with more creative and effective ways of getting people interested in these issues. Young people should be saying more about this, because if the climate goes in the terrible direction it's going, they're going to suffer the most.
Yeah. Trina in Watertown. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen and Jeremy. So my oldest daughter just finished her freshman year at UW-La Crosse, and she has turned into this mysterious creature. She chose to put together a group that went out to D.C. that protested the Keystone Pipeline. She got arrested, which completely freaks us out. She's leading a divestment campaign at her school. We're terribly proud of her, but my husband and I grew up, you know, came of age in the early 1990s. We got our degrees, got married, and had a person with kids. We're leading a quiet life. So this activist in our midst, we don't know what to do with her. I don't know how to support her. I don't know what advice would you have for parents of kids who do care and are trying to get involved in the political process?
I Trina, I think it's great that she's doing this, and I think you should encourage her and offer her whatever kind of support you can, and let her see this as a key part of her learning process, because there are going to be so many pressures the other way. There are going to be so many people telling her this is jeopardizing her getting a job, this is not taking her where she needs to go, and she's lucky to have parents like you who will encourage this.
Hmm. I was grateful that there are some of the old guard in the community out in La Crosse who were activists in the 60s and 70s who come alongside these kids and kind of mentor them, which is helpful.
That's great.
Because, again, you know, I can't do it.
That's right. No, and I think, and I want to be clear, I think there are a lot of people from different generations and backgrounds who have a lot to offer, and they should be involved in this process. This is not about one generation against another, though it can sometimes sound that way. But it is about not allowing the conventional wisdom from an older, wiser group to crowd out the creative thinking of a younger group. We need our young people to be more creative and more risk-taking than ever before if we're going to get through the problems we face.
So she begs the question here, Trina, by her story, how important are parents or families in fostering activism? Or does it have nothing to do with whether or not you as a young person will be an activist?
No.
Jeremy?
I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's you. Yeah.
I thought you were asking Tamina. Pardon me.
It's all right.
I think young people are crucially dependent upon parents, and I think what parents need to do most of all is to open possibilities for young people, and that doesn't just mean financial support. Making it clear that college is not pre-professional. Most people are not going to get their dream job when they graduate from college. That's not why they're going to college. They're going to college to be fuller human beings. And I understand the pressures that lead parents to say otherwise, but I think it's absolutely crucial that Trina's parents and others encourage their children to be creative and take the risks now and worry about jobs later. It's easy for me to say, but that's really what they have to do.
Thanks, Trina. Dan and Rhinelander, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Matt and Pat kind of usurped some of the things I wanted to say, but make it very quickly. You know, we train people to be smart, and they're very distracted by the things around them. I believe what your guest just said is a very idealistic but a laudable goal, but most people go to college to get jobs. Now, I also disagree with him about what happened in the 60s. Having entered college in 68, there was a unifying thing. There wasn't much understanding of both sides, and I really have to apologize to take issue with him on that. But I think we get smart kids, they're sick of the polarization. And I think it's hope versus reality. With the financial situations they find themselves in, the more informed you get, the more you should focus a little bit on what you can do at the local level. The other thing is, just very briefly, there's a book I read, you know, people really don't mature all the way until they're 28 to 32 years old. So I believe he's right, taking risk. I took risks, did weird things until I was about 35 years old. And you know, really, you know, put your neck out there, experience things, because the things you experience just whack you on the side of the head as to what you were growing up with and what you thought and what, you know, what it means to really change the world.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. And I think you're right. There is a hope versus reality. What I'm saying as a historian is that society needs hope, even if that hope is naive. There's a natural process to this, and that hope. College is about creating hope and people having hope and being idealistic and then learning as they go on in life that their ideals don't match the reality and scaling back but not giving up their ideals. Mm. And I think our young people are jumping too fast to the realities without the hope.
Mm. Do you think, would you agree with the title of Studs Terkel's, one of his last books, Hope Dies Last?
But I think also hope needs cultivation. And there's so many pressures on young people from very early on to give up hope now and accept things as they are. It's not about becoming depressed, but it's about accepting the world as it is rather than trying to make the world better. And I think we need to cultivate that. It does. It lasts long, but it has to be cultivated.
Yeah. Kathleen, Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. This is a great show. And I was an activist at Marquette University back in the 60s and 70s when the protest marches were led by the priests and the nuns every day at 4 o'clock. They'd meet outside Jesu. And part of my comment is in regards to the lady from La Crosse and what to do with her daughter. My parents set aside a slush fund of about $300 in case I ever got arrested.
Oh.
And that was in the days when the $300 was more than 300 hours
right.
of work.
Yeah.
Minimum wage was like 75 cents an hour. And about 10 years ago, before my mother died, and I was quite old then, my mother told me about the slush fund and asked if there was any chance of my getting arrested because she'd like to release the money now. And the other thing is, I've read that the most arrested man in all of Hollywood has the last name of Sheen. And it's not Charlie. It's Martin, who received the Marquette Award. And allegedly, he's been arrested more than 60 sometimes. You'll have to check the facts. And when he gets arrested, the lawyer's already on call. He's arrested with a Bible, a rosary, and wearing a suit and tie. And he's getting arrested for protesting nuclear sites and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So there's still people out there doing it, and the lady in La Crosse, God bless her, and I've never been arrested. So,
well, do you still
have that slush fund?
Do you still have the slush fund, Kathleen?
No, my mom, she released the money. She told me about it about 10 years ago, and she died about 8 years ago. So,
well, you can always start another.
Yeah. I think this is great, and young people need to hear these stories. That's the other thing. What Kathleen is recounting, young people need to hear, because the model they have, the image they have, is that you're supposed to go to college and
right.
just go on with your life. And they need to recognize college is not just pre-professional. You have to get a job at some point, but you're not just in college for that alone.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jeremy, so much. It was really a lively, interesting conversation. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, and I learned a lot from your callers.
Yeah,
wonderful
aren't they
callers.
Great? They're just great. I know, I'm with
they
you.
Are.
Jeremy Suri, our guest, professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, author of a number of books, including Power and Protest, Global Revolution, and the Rise of Détente. We're with you tomorrow for another full 2 hours, and we're going to be talking about some interesting issues, how race is contributing to political polarization in the Milwaukee area. Our guest has studied how stark racial segregation creates politically divided metropolitan areas. And then at 2, do animals have legal rights? Can a chimpanzee sue its owner? Our guest, a legal scholar in the field of animal law. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour and to Marika Suval for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you for listening.